started on tonight's class. All right. So we're on our second class on Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. A sweet little book, which is often recommended to people who are new to Zen, but it's actually really, I don't know, it's like it's as dense as Dogen, man. It's like, so last week we started on the first chapter, Posture, and I opened it up to questions and we never really got past the first paragraph. So we'll see what happens tonight. I would hopefully again be able to how many folks in the Dirt Sendo tonight? There were 11 of us at one point. I'm not sure if there's still 11 of us. So hopefully this will be a question driven discussion again, like last time. That was very interesting to just see what was coming alive for people. So if from the reading you already have questions, we'll start with those. Then I'll just kind of work my way through it and let the conversation happen. But I did first want to just do a little overview of the themes in this tiny little chapter. It's like a page and a half long. Two and a half pages long. So he talks about samadhi, which is, he doesn't mention the word samadhi, but he talks about samadhi, which is a state of non-dual awareness where the sense of separation between subject, self, observer, meditator, and object, anything and everything else, falls away, allowing you to perceive the independent dimension of reality. So this is in the chapter where he says, if you think I breathe, the I is extra. There is no you to say I. He talks about Buddha nature. But to be aware of the movement of breathing does not mean to be aware of your small self, but rather of your universal nature or Buddha nature. Later on, he talks about direct experience versus some kind of understanding we can obtain. He says, you and I are just swinging doors. This kind of understanding is necessary. This should not even be called understanding. It is actually the true experience of life through Zen practice. Then he talks about the oneness of time and space and experience. The time and space are one. To eat lunch is itself 1 o'clock. He talks about attachment, how our attachment to our discriminations is not necessary. He says good and bad are only in your mind. We should not say this is good or this is bad. Instead of saying bad, you should say not to do. If you think this is bad, it will create some confusion for you. So in the realm of pure religion, there is no confusion of time and space or good and bad. All that we should do is just do something as it comes. And then he talks about simultaneous dependence and independence. When we truly become ourselves, we just become a swinging door, and we are purely independent of, and at the same time, dependent upon everything. So it's impossible for our discussion to cover all of those topics in one night. It's pretty amazing. So I'm hoping that our discussion will be based on questions, and I'll open it up to questions. If anybody has questions from the reading, we can go then, either you can or I can, and read the relevant section. So in case there's anybody with us who hasn't like read the chapter, they'll know what we're talking about. So open it up. And I have a plan if nobody says anything, but last time we just had to kind of let it sit for a while. And Linda is our first one to go again. Thank you. Oh, you're still muted.
Okay. Yeah, I was reading this and, you know, it made my brain do calisthenics. So I have one of the things that I was struggling with, is he just talking about when you're sitting zazen, or is he talking about life, you know, in general? Because when he says there's no 1 o'clock, well, when I was working, there was a meeting at one, it was at 1 o'clock. So I'm not sure if he's just talking about when you're sitting or like in life.
I would say that that he's talking about life. I mean, he's also talking about sitting, but our form of sitting is like a microcosm of our life. Mm-hmm. I feel like how we sit zazen is how we do everything. And I mean, we're just sitting. Now, you don't just sit while you're driving or talk to somebody, but you can be just driving and you can be just talking to someone. You know, there's a singleness of absorption in whatever activity we're doing. So we can bring that same approach to everything. And then that, you know, that it's true in a relative sense, we do think about good and bad, and we do have to come up with some convention of time so that we all show up at the same place together and we can run our lives. But it's really pointing to that, how all of that is this is all conceptual overlay that we put on reality for a good reason. It's very natural. And sometimes it's very positive. But when we fail to realize that it does not have inherent reality in and of itself, that things as it is, are as they are, it doesn't matter what time we're labeling them.
Okay.
It's just this moment, right? It's just kind of this arbitrary label that we agree. And then, right, like another time zone over, it's not 1 o'clock. What does that mean? Is it the same time? Is it not the same time? You know, so it's that relative aspect where it's saying like, and the only reason for the convention of time is to somehow label and organize our experiences, which are happening. They're not dependent on that label. So really, like having lunch at 1 o'clock is just, it's just lunch. So if anybody has any other, you know, thoughts on that or comments, you're welcome to join in. Or other questions. Karen.
First of all, I really liked the concept of the swinging door of your breath, either being in or out. That just visually, that really helped me. And I think another idea or way of putting it was either inside the gate or outside the gate. Anyway, for me, it kind of, because I can sometimes start paying attention to my breath too much and I start breathing weird. But anyway, that kind of helped me. But so I think this sentence, which is so confusing to me, I felt like reading this, like one little piece would, I'd be like, oh, I get that. It seems to make sense. And then like the next sentence would be so confusing to me. So this is at the end of, well, on my book, it's page 13. But anyway, it says, in your mind, you create an idea of place separate from actual time. I don't know. I just don't get that. Because to me, in your mind, you create an idea of place separate from an actual time. And to me, those are two different things.
Yeah. Interesting. I guess what I'm taking from that is there is a sense in Buddhism, and I mean Dogen wrote a fascicle on it, and I can't say that I have not thoroughly studied it. I've not studied really at all, but he equates time with being. Time is being. So I think in this sense he's saying the actual time is like right here, this circumstance. If you're having lunch, right? He's saying that's the actual time. So he's kind of mixing time and place. I don't think he's meaning to like, yeah. He did speak English as a second language. So I'm thinking of the idea of a place other than where we are, which is something that we do all the time, of course, right? Wherever we are, whatever we're doing, we're thinking of where else we could be. And in some ways he's saying like, that's not like, this is the time, this is the actual time. This is where we are right now. You can't be in another place at this time, but we think about it a lot. I don't know, that's my take on it.
Okay.
Chris.
Related to that, and not in any way to suggest that like I fully get this or get this at all really, or that I understand the other side, it strikes me that recent relatively recent research in quantum physics has identified time space as a single thing, that the common notion of time and space as two different things of which we have some awareness through our consciousness has largely been disproven in science. And I can't speak to the specifics of that, but they talk about the fabric of space-time, that consciousness's perception of those two separate things is actually not a separate thing. Time and space are one thing. And that's what resonated for me when I was reading those passages in this.
Yeah, I think that's just fascinating the way that modern physics is actually corroborating, you know, what spiritual mystics have been saying for a long time, what Dogen was saying. And I think for the purposes of our practice and study that if we try to engage that space and time and being and all that intellectually or even philosophically, most of us will get quickly lost. You know, it's kind of like a rabbit hole to go down. I mean, it might be kind of fun. And, you know, even a quantum physicist, you know, might be able to talk at length about it. And yet really like, what do I say, you know, to some extent, knowledge is knowing what you don't know. And it's the quantum physicists who truly have that sense of like, we don't really even know what's going on here, people. So even they would be like, you know, there would be a limit to like an understanding of what's going on. But fortunately, we don't need to wrap our mind around this as a philosophical concept, right? It doesn't have to be like, as a Zen student, you need to understand how time and space and being are one. But we can look deeply into our own experience. So another way of putting this is experientially, only this moment exists. And in fact, it doesn't even have a dimension. It's not like, you know, how long is a moment? As soon as we like conceive of a length of time, that's actually an abstraction. This is just, it's just now, 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 now. now and here, because there's always a here associated with that now. That's all that is actually real. And so in this moment, there's a constellation of people and things and causes and conditions in this universe, which I don't think in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, but somewhere else, Suzuki Roshi called it things as it is. Which I love how that includes the multiplicity of everything, but also just the oneness of everything. It's just reality. Things as it is includes everything, though, including my inclination to move in a particular direction, including, you know, everything that makes me up. My knowledge and my conditioning and everything is here. It from causes in the past, and it will condition what happens next. I may have a thought about whether something should be resisted or encouraged in the next moment. And responses arise, especially when we do cultivate the state of mind he's talking about, responses arise very freely. And usually they are our best responses. You know, they may not be like omniscient responses or like necessarily always get the result we want, but they're probably our best response. And they may even be responses, like Suzuki points out, which are not to do. You know, however we're meeting the moment, if we're acting or not acting, this is a choice. So any thoughts about past and future or future are abstractions. And any thoughts, as he goes on and relates these two closely, any thoughts about good or bad are abstractions. In this moment, a lively and passionate response may arise. It may be time to, you know, stand up and risk our lives to stand up for something. That's arising right here. And later, to discuss it with people or to communicate or, you know, make a plan or create narratives, then, you know, we abstract about it and we describe it and we say that's good or that's bad or that's just or unjust or whatever. And there's a certain truth and utility to all of that. I mean, we have to do that. And yet all of that is mental abstraction when you compare it to reality. And they should not be set up as opposites. They should not be set up in a tension. But being able to recognize that the emptiness of those, of all of our thoughts and abstractions, including our ideas about time and ideas about space, they're not real the way that this very moment is real. So those were my thoughts on his time and space are one. There, questions or comments or Mark?
So there's lunch at one and there's hungry.
Can you guys online hear him? Oh, okay. we got a couple of these.
So there's lunch at one and there's hungry at 12:59. And there's lunch at one depends on hungry at 12:59, and hungry at 12:59 depends on lunch at one. Is all of that not to do?
What do you mean?
And hungry at 12:59 is just hungry at 12:59, and lunch at one is just lunch at one. Is anything else than that not to do?
I don't know what you mean. Are you saying?
We live in this world of apparent causation, right? This comes from that, that comes from this. We see all of these links and these dependencies. And that's the cornerstone of all the narratives we come up with, is causation. So is that not to do?
I'm not sure we're not to do comes into it, but the causation is real. And that's where, that's why the Dharma teaching is always coupled with moral precepts and guidance for behavior, because it can sound like we're saying, hey, good and bad don't exist. It's just this moment. Like it can sound like we're denying causation, and it's not denying causation. It's just, yeah. So I guess, I mean, the way that helps me the most is that whole idea of like the independent dimension versus the dependent dimension of reality. Dependent being the time and space and causality, which is a dimension of our life. But then there's this independent dimension, which has no dimension, which is right. It's just right here, right now. And it's a dimension, but it's not the dimension, right? It doesn't cancel out the other. So at any given moment, there's like this, there's complete freedom in this moment. Even though we're in this stream of causation, there's just this complete freedom of this moment, which to some extent is just a spiritual solace, because you can be in the middle of a major stream of difficult causation and, you know, being able to, you know, pause for a moment and tap into the independent dimension doesn't make all that go away. But it can, you know, give us some freedom and some strength and some perspective. So then actually when we do engage in the stream of causation, we're coming from a better place. And I mean, not to do or to do, that those are like, I feel like those come from, they do not come from our conscious mind usually. Even when we think they're coming from our conscious mind, they're not often coming from our conscious mind. It's coming from, you know, what is right here, right now? I am the result of this whole stream of causation. And so when I encounter something, a response arises, just like that. And from my experience of other, experience of life and other disciplines, the more you can allow that response to arise just like that, the more appropriate it is, the better it is. So it may be not to do, it may be to do. We don't know. We can't know ahead of time, which is a little nerve-wracking.
Thank you.
Nick.
Okay, so I'm still fascinated by this notion of independent and dependent dimensions. And so I have I'm a math person, and independent dimension means something very specific to me, and dependent and independent. But what I noticed this time when you were talking about it, you talked about the independent dimension and you did it like this. And you talked about the dependent dimension and you're like this. And that makes me think, like, do they share aspects? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, if I take a piece of paper, which has like lots of, but then I point it like this, it disappears. Does what I'm saying make sense? Can anything from the independent dimension like be...
No, you won't understand it that way. And I would say, you know, it's like, they don't share characteristics because the independent dimension has no characteristics. There are no characteristics there. It's just what is. It has a characteristic, though, of like suchness, I guess, of being kind of amazing and luminous and just incredible for existing. I guess that's a characteristic. It's a quality. But, you know, they're descriptions of one reality. So that's where I like the dimension. It's not another dimension we go to, it's one reality. So that's where I kind of like the three dimensions, right? You can't have anything that's just two dimensional. Everything has three dimensions. So in this sense, it's like you've got the independent dimension and the dependent dimension are qualities, you know, aspects of the same thing. So you can't separate them out or correspond them. maybe like, I don't know, you're like, you know, trying to get your mind around length without width or something like that. I think Linda's next.
Okay, so his reference of good and bad, he says good and bad are only in your mind. So we should not say this is good or this is bad. Instead of saying bad, you should say not to do. So I guess one thought that came to my mind when I read that was like if you see a big, like if you see a big giant mug of beer, right? That's like as tall as you are. And you like beer, which I really don't, okay. But if you do, and you look at that, and you know that if you're living by the guidelines, then you shouldn't drink all that beer and lose your faculties, right? Because that's not within the moral guidelines. So instead of saying that's bad, you can say not to do. So that's your choice, making your choice. Is that kind of like, what is not to do? Like, that's just not to do. It's not bad, but it's just not to do. Is that what he means by not to do?
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. And that what it reminds me of is the importance of pointing out that a lot of what he's talking about here is from what we call the absolute perspective versus the relative perspective. So we have those two aspects of reality, dependent dimension, independent dimension. Mm-hmm. So he's talking about kind of ultimately, there is no good and no bad. And yet, one of the ways that we hold the precepts is to understand that, you know, there's a time for them and for other things in our life for just to be rules that we try to follow because somebody told us they were healthy. And so, you know, we're gonna try. And it's, so we just kind of keep them in mind and we just do them. And we might think, you know, okay, that's good and that's bad. So there's a practical aspect to that, but kind of ideally, over time, we are converted to the precepts. So they become a description of enlightened behavior. So that when we encounter that giant beer, we go, I don't really want to do that because that's just going to make me feel terrible. Mm-hmm. Like, and then it is just not to do. Mm-hmm. Like we've been able to let go of all of our ideas about good and bad. And then it is really more of just that response. But sometimes we can't necessarily trust ourselves in the moment.
Right.
Because we have habits and stuff like that. So then, you know, we do have like a do not indulge anger. Okay, do not indulge anger. Like, and we might keep it as a little bit of a rule and a, you know, so. But even then, you know, it's extra baggage to put on to say to indulge anger is bad. More realistically is to indulge anger is often harmful. To indulge anger often means you do or say things you regret. So, you know, it has a very practical basis. Good question.
Yeah, and I have something related to that. So, like, you look, you read the newspapers and you look at what's happening on the news, and you definitely can see that there's, in my mind, bad stuff. So it's hard for me to say that there's no bad, I guess.
Well, there is definitely there's definitely suffering and, you know, selfish and violent behaviors that cause suffering, and, you know, there's destruction, and all of that is real.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most of us recognize that there's a level at which we can recognize what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
And recognize our, like, say, you know, that looks pretty terrible to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it usually is not helpful to start creating a narrative about how it's bad or evil, or the people who are doing it are bad or evil, because then it becomes kind of we've created a thing.
Mm-hmm.
We've kind of concretized, or deified our idea about it, which usually is not accurate. If we were actually to meet the people involved or meet the circumstances, we'd recognize a lot of things that we don't see from afar. So to me, that's what it points to in that larger sense of just not, that usually laying on the label of good or bad is not actually helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're in a way, it's just semantics, the words we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Well,
I was just going to say that, you know, saying label something good or bad is judgmental, and the more your mind judges something, the less spaciousness it has. And you really, that's the purpose of the meditation, is to move into that more spacious place. So it's difficult to do that if you're labeling something good or bad. Mm-hmm. And really, the innate nature of something isn't good or bad too. I think mm-hmm. when you're in that place, you can more or less see that. But when you're in the place of being in a meeting and discussing things, it's more difficult to see. You want to comment on that?
Well, can you come closer to the microphone, just so the Zoom people can hear you?
Oh, okay. Just a little comment. Silly comment. Okay, well, I don't think that we're capable of knowing if something is bad or good. I'm losing my mind. Not really. We think we're capable, but I don't think that we actually are. Because I don't think who am I to think this, but we don't understand mostly what is going on around us, and then we make judgments, like you're saying.
But we do. If you saw an adult out, you know, whack their kid, you know, yell abusively at them and whack them, I mean, wouldn't there be part of you that would, like, There's something you would recognize there that is not right, right?
Yes, but I don't think, I worked in a big trauma center, an ER, for years. I saw all sorts of things, bullet to the head, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that I don't know what's actually going on. I may not want that to go on in front of me, or I may turn someone into the authorities to let them deal mm-hmm. with it. But that's just how I've come to grips.
I think, you know, because some of this is just you know, the words that we use. And I'm thinking that a lot of times what we're thinking here with good and bad mm-hmm. is we're kind of, to me, what that's pointing toward is a judgment we wake of, like, this is acceptable in my world and this is not. So it's beyond just recognizing, like, that's a action that I want to stop, or that's something in the world I want to work for and endorse. It's like, yes, like it's a kind of a personal oriented ultimate judgment about, like, I'm not, if it's bad, I'm not, it doesn't belong, and I'm not going to consider it, and I'm not going to give it any leeway. You know what I mean? I think that's what we're pointing at here, is that deeper kind of visceral, really self-absorbed kind of judgment, which, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I think it's interesting, because I think in the same way that we can create a separate place in our mind of, like, I can visualize myself here, I think when you do things like that, you're sort of making a statement that says, like, I know what good is, and this is that. And I know what bad is, and this is that. And you're creating these things in your mind that don't exist. Like good and bad are these just sort of, like, universally applicable concepts that I think are just simplifying to an extent that is too much.
So I see Zach has had your hand up for quite a while. Are you going to say something about a completely different topic?
Yes, but as this is going on, I also wanted to say on this topic, I think there is some truth to that. We don't understand, like, talking about causation, all of the causation of something, right? Like, we don't know, maybe that parent was yelling at their child because, you know, they're on drugs and they're trying to, you know, get them to stop. Or we don't know, when we see something horrible in the news, what good may come of it later. So, there, you know, we don't know, we don't understand how one thing affects everything else in the world. We, none of us are capable of understanding that.
So we'll come back to you for your next topic. Jen.
I just have maybe a quick question about, I mean, I guess I thought of it differently when you brought up, like, a parent hitting a child, you could feel that that's a thing not to do, and not to do because of all of the consequences that would unfold from that action that may have been, like, a thoughtless action that could have bigger consequences. So in the dimension that you're talking about with causation, doesn't that just bring in a lot of negative or ugly things into existence that if you had ceased doing such thing or not to do that thing, you would have had a different outcome?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the, you know, from the beginning of Buddhism, the emphasis has been on appropriate behavior, and on behavior, not appropriate because some God told you it's appropriate, but because, like, the invitation is, well, look at what happens. Mm-hmm. If you do this, if you act greedy, if you lie, if you steal, if you, you know, have a bad livelihood, you know, suffering is created. And so, you know, that's like, causation is very complex, and it doesn't, just because it's complex, doesn't absolve us of responsibility for trying to make the best decisions we can and trying to, you know, make the best choices we can. So yeah, I mean, that is, you know, this is a powerful teaching, this whole, you know, there is no good or bad, but it's also, you know, it's like a sword. It's got two edges. It can be a very negative teaching as well, if it is taken to mean that, you know, we're not responsible, or even to recognize our limited knowledge and that we can't predict how things are going to turn out. When we're really when we're really present and that wholehearted response comes up, whether that's to do or not to do, that it's not about predicting some outcome. It's a response to this, the circumstances, and it doesn't have to be just instantaneous. We may know things which inform our behavior in this moment. So it's not just some kind of subconscious thing. Our whole being comes to this moment and then does our best. And that's what we're trying to do. So that, that no good or bad is really about freeing us up to act even more appropriately in the world, not giving us a pass because we can't predict what the outcome will be. We do it with great humility, you know? And I think that's a huge difference too, if we are trying to take action in the world, to come from the point of view that, like, from where I'm sitting, this needs to happen. It looks to me like this needs to happen, and I'm gonna try to make that happen. But we remain open, right? Because we haven't closed off our mind in some narrative of good and bad. We're like, this looks like I need to do this. Maybe at some point we'll be like, oh, okay, this is different than I thought it was. And yeah, we move forward like that in a very fresh and open way, ready to be informed at any moment. So, Zach, you got something else?
So I actually think kind of these as I was sitting here thinking, these two things kind of tie together a bit. I was going to start by saying, you know, to me, this teaching about, you know, the moment we're in is reality. It has been the most helpful thing to me. You know, I came to Zen, I came to this book because of the suffering in my life. And whether that was the suffering that I put on other people or the suffering that was put on me or whatever, I dwelt on that. And it, you know, was something that I constantly thought about and just, you know, put this enormous amount of pressure on me. And then understanding that the moment that I'm in now is real. The past is the past and it's gone and you can't change it. You can't do anything about it. It is what it is, whether it was, you know, labeled good or bad, it has happened. And the future is not yet here. It may come, it may not come. It, you know, who knows? The moment that is now is the only thing I have any control over. And so all I can do is make my decisions and take my actions based on that. And so I think, like spiritually, when we're thinking about that, it like you said, I think we can try to intellectualize it and we can try to, you know, understand the words, but really the point is, like, we can't dwell on these things because that just brings us more sorrow, more pain, more negativity. We can just accept that they are what they were and be where we are at.
Yeah, and as someone who I'm very, like, ambitious and active and have all kinds of ideas for improving the world, and you know, I was wondering in my practice, like, well, how do I, like, honor this, you know, only this moment is real thing, and, you know, still live this life that is full of projects and stuff that are aimed on, you know, ideas and, you know, goals and the future. And my most helpful thing, one line from Uchiyama Rushi's book about the Tenzo Kyokan. And he talks about how the Tenzo, the cook of the monastery, is staying up until the wee hours of the morning, carefully calculating how much food they're going to need the next day. They have to think of how many people are in the monastery. Is there anybody in the sick room? And then everybody eats this much and we have to get this and it's going to serve a lot with this. So all these calculations, all these preparations. And he says, that is the Tenzo's work of this moment. All of that is the wholehearted work of this moment, which is like, oh, okay, you know, it can happen, but it is not actually dependent on all of that coming to pass.
Yeah, in the same way, I think, like, you know, balancing your checkbook is making sure the money you spent in the past is not there, and you're not going to go negative. And making sure you budget to pay your rent or your mortgage, like, those are things you're doing now. That doesn't mean you're worrying about the past or doing this about the, you know, it's what you're doing.
And the freedom of this very moment is just, you know, that the more, the deeper we can make our conviction that all of these thoughts, all of these narratives are not inherently real. I mean, they're real in a sense. Dreams are real in a sense. You know, clouds are real in a sense. So all of these narratives and thoughts are part of our experience, but they don't have inherent reality. And a great example I think of this is, you know, we may be in relationships and we may be dissatisfied in those relationships because we have ideas about how they should go, how our parents should be, our siblings should be, our spouses should be. And we can get very, very upset because it's not panning out the way that we thought. And when, you know, you do get, you know, a conviction of like, and who said, you know, what is this but a story of how, you know, two people are supposed to relate? You know, so how does it actually look? How is your actual experience of it? And usually it's not nearly as torturous if you simply are with whatever, you know, things as it is, and give up those comparisons. Dukkha is just, you know, just being dissatisfied with reality. Got a few minutes. Anything else?
Well, I was looking at the moon last night, you know, and I started to say, well, it's not quite full, and I was doing a lot of analysis, and it's not high in the sky, and then I just took a moment to kind of be with the moon. There was nothing going on, it was just being the moon, and I was standing there in wonder, more or less, and not doing anything with my mind around it. So, I don't know, I think that's a Zen moment, if you want. Mm-hmm.
Just as a side note, the branching streams flow in the darkness is where Things as It Is from. If anybody.
Oh, okay. Great. Yeah. Thanks. So I wrote a few questions to myself about the Buddha nature part, where, you know, he's talking about the breath is the swinging door. And there's no I who's breathing, no I who's meditating, there's no inside or outside, just breathing. He said, but we are aware of this moment. You should not be absent-minded, but to be aware of the moment does not mean to be aware of your small self, but rather of your universal nature or Buddha nature. So that raised questions. You know, what is awareness of small self? What is awareness of Buddha nature? What is Buddha nature? When all the details are stripped away, who are you? When concern about defining self, How is this self, self versus other? How is this self in the world? When all concern about defining self is dropped, what are you? What is left? We're encouraged to, in our zazen, and then that's where we practice it. And then we try to extend it further out. And we try to see through all the narratives we have about ourselves and the world and our lives, just recognizing they're just narratives, right? The whole, like, don't believe everything you think. You know, it's just thoughts, or it's just emotions. Emotions always have thoughts involved. So we're encouraged to just, and we do this in retreat, particularly longer retreats, just encourage you to, like, all that stuff that you usually care about so much, just set it aside. Don't worry about whether you are smart or dull, whether you are ambitious or lazy, whether you are loved or awkward, or you did many terrible things in your life, or you're really proud of your life, or whatever. You think you're beautiful, you think you're ugly, you think you're thin, you think you're fat, you think you know, setting aside all of that, all of the things that anything that we identify as us or belonging to us, none of this matters here. None of it matters. So when you're just sitting there, and all of those details don't matter, you know, who are we? What are we? What is left? There is something left. It can't be grasped. It is aliveness itself. That seems like a good place to leave it. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.